am reasonably sure that David Roth of Defector has never been introduced with Muskrat Love. Hello, David.
Hi. What an amazing honor. This is on me because my phone's ringer was off, so I completely missed these calls and was like, oh, just Rich and Carrie running behind today. My fault. Sorry about that.
It's not. You know what? You're a Hall of Famer now. You were in the Downtown Hall of Fame. You show up when you want to show up, damn it.
This is why they make people retire before they induct them into the Hall of Fame, though, because that was some real, like, post-retirement Pete Rose behavior. It was like, yeah, it's $15 for me to sign you ball, kid. So, sorry about that.
Don't worry about that.
How are you
doing? I am great. Can I tell you a quick Pete Rose story? You just reminded me of that years ago.
Please.
Years ago, I was down. I had a friend who managed I think it was a Holiday Inn down in either Delray Beach or Boca Raton, Florida. And in the restaurant at the time, Pete Rose did his radio show from there. And he would float around and talk with people in the restaurant, but you had to buy Pete Rose authorized items. He would not sign anything else. But the best part of it was there were these little like menu cards, and it listed all of Pete Rose's accomplishments. And on several of them, somebody had taken a permanent marker and crossed out all of the baseball accomplishments and wrote in things like bet on baseball, cheated on his wives, and just listed all these things and did it on several of these cards. And I don't think Pete knew they were out there, but people would be laughing. And Pete's like, well, people having a good time in the restaurant tonight here at Pete Rose's.
That's great, especially because I think Pete Rose being Pete Rose, like the secret sauce there is that he'd be like, yeah, it's $5 extra to sign the ones that are defaced with cheated on his wives. Like, there's just not, he's not going to get embarrassed. It's not like a thing that he does. So you just sort of have to let him do what he's going to do.
I love
That's
it.
Great. That is definitely, Delray Beach is Pete Rose country, man. I feel like there's probably, like, there's more Pete Rose mindset loose in Florida in general than in any other U.S. state, and I'm glad that that's where he settled.
I'm pretty sure Pete is right now with somebody's wife in the Villages.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's like where he should be, like, driving a golf cart around, like kind of just open container stuff, but he's like, you don't understand, I'm the hit king every time he gets in trouble for anything.
To be honest, that explains a lot of my dislike of Pete Rose from the time I was a kid and was a fan of the Reds, except for Pete Rose.
Really? Because that's I know that he, when I was a kid, so I grew up, you know, in the 80s, so he was already declining. Like, I never got to see, like, the cool version of Pete Rose, such as that ever existed. But he was always the example of, like, that's why you got to run to first as fast as you can whenever you take a walk. It's like every obnoxious baseball thing. He was always the teaching point. And yet when I saw him, his hair was totally gray. He had like the Dorothy Hamill haircut by then, you know, just kind of just a weird bowl cut. And I was like, that caveman, like, I'm supposed to do what he's doing. I want to do what Daryl Strawberry's doing. That looks cool. But that was not what the coaches wanted you to do.
David Roth with us here on Downtown. I see you visited, a shrine from your younger days.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity to say I have to go to the mall for work. It's not a sentence that I would have gotten to say if Defector hadn't worked out, but my coworker Dan McQuaid and I went to a gigantic mall in the swamps of North Jersey. It was like sort of New Jersey's attempt to create a Mall of America thing, and they kind of landed closer to, it's like a version, if the main mall was also an airport, is sort of the vibe in terms of where they actually landed. But they built it right on the parking lot outside of the former Brendan Byrne Arena, which is where the New Jersey Nets played when I was a kid. So when we were leaving the mall after having done the various mall things you do, you know, take escalators and look at a Lids franchise and whatever, throw a penny in a fountain and leave, this incredible, you know, sight of my middle school, not even really trauma. I didn't expect good things to happen with them. It was just a place where I would go before I was in actual therapy. I would just go to Nets games and scream, and it's still there. It's kind of like empty and haunted looking. I learned after the fact that apparently bands, it's like, so it's still like a place with good acoustics and, you know, whatever, 18,000 seats. they just don't have events there. But apparently before bands go on big national arena tours, they will go there and rehearse at that arena.
Wow.
To like get a sense of like on that scale and in that sound, which is sort of funny to me, the idea of like there's this giant mall nearby. There's a, like more parking there than there is at Newark Airport. There's the ghosts of the Devils and the Nets there. And then somehow also like the Cure is practicing there.
That's fantastic.
It's just kind of cool to think about.
Ghost arena only used for practice.
Mm-hmm. Which is good. It's kind of like the old, what they used to say about like used cars that had only been driven to church by old ladies or whatever. Like nobody has played like a set for actual people in that space, but somehow like whatever, the Killers were there for two straight weeks before their most recent tour.
So. The NBA playoffs getting down to crunch time here. I feel like the league would dearly love to have the Celtics and the Lakers, but it's not exactly shaping up that way.
Yeah. I mean, I feel, as if the Celtics have a better chance of obliging there than the Lakers. I'm not really sure that there's going to be two games in a row where Jason Tatum seems that nervous and out of it. But yeah, it is kind of funny. Like, cause to me, like the Nuggets are a marquee team. Like I make a point of watching them when I can, cause I find Jokic so fascinating and they play a pretty fun style. Like of the teams that are remaining in the playoffs, I think that they're the most sort of freewheeling or, you know, just they're going to surprise you the most. Like the Celtics are really good, but they've been good in this way for, you know, 4 or 5 years. And it's more or less, you know, individual stuff. And yet, like, I definitely am aware that, you know, Lakers Celtics is so close and they could very well wind up with, you know, something much less exciting. I kind of can't stand the Miami Heat, but I have reached a sort of a grudging peace with them that like they are the most annoying team
probably
in major professional sports,
which
is, you know, and that's not a small achievement, you know, like you sort of have to tip your cap to them. And if you're not better than them, they will beat you, which is what good teams do. It makes me really glad that I don't have a serious rooting interest in the NBA's Eastern Conference. Cause oh brother, like I would detest watching them play against the Heat.
Apparently, if we look at the standings, $364 million or so doesn't buy what it used to in Major League Baseball.
I'm convinced that the Mets are turning it around because they won two straight against the Rays. Now, it is true that they spent a month losing to teams that are going to lose 90 games this year, and that was bad. But I can't believe, I think in the same case with the Padres, obviously I'm a little less motivated reasoning there. It's weird that both teams have been as bad as they are, but the thing that I've been telling myself, and you can tell me how convincing this sounds if you're not me, is that the reason that you build a roster that has like a 95 win projection, which basically the Mets and the Padres both did going into the season, is that even if you get the 25th percentile outcome from that, like, you know, if a bunch of things break wrong, or if in the Mets case, you're just throwing a bunch of like sort of triple A ham and egger guys on the mound because none of your pitchers can be healthy at once. Even if you get the 20th percentile outcome, you're still around the wild card. Whereas what the Mets used to try to do, and the Padres were always sort of more ambitious. They're in a different spot than I think the Mets are because they're committed to this roster for like 8 more years contractually. The Mets don't have a lot of long-term contracts, but they do. They're spending all of this money, but at least they're spending it in a way that like gives them a high ceiling. The old move that the Wilpons would do would be to build a roster that if everything went right, they'd win 87 games. And that would put them in the wild card. But nothing ever goes right all the way through a season. And then it's like if you start slipping down that chart, suddenly, you know, you get to 78 wins means you're nowhere. So in this case, I want to believe, you know, the Mets are a game and a half back of the wild card right now, which is kind of an embarrassing thing to know, given that it is objectively the middle of May. But I've really been like kind of puzzled by it. You can see how it's happened, like, you know, that it's the pitching stuff goes downhill. The offense just wasn't clicking with runners on base. It still isn't really. I've watched a lot of, you know, teams in that uniform lose games in annoying ways. It's just, it never quite made sense to me. Like when things go really wrong and the wheels come off and everybody's playing out of position and people are injured, there's that. Mets have more or less had their lineup together. They've just stunk. And I can't believe that that's going to go on forever. Or at least, you know, if I believed it now, then I'd have a lot more free time later in the summer, but I haven't gotten there yet.
That was actually very convincing.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't feel convincing, but I appreciate it. You're very kind.
In the meantime, here in New England, the Red Sox, with a payroll of only about $198 million, are viewed as the scrappy underdogs because they're within a game of the wild card spot.
They've been, I think that this is the secret to being happy as a fan, is that, you know, most of the time you're not going to get to see your team win the World Series. And if that's where you're putting the floor, then you're going to be upset a lot of the time. With the Red Sox, I feel like a little bit of overperforming with this roster, which it is overperforming right now. Like, I would not have guessed that Yoshida, for instance, was like this good, but a little bit of being positively surprised goes a long way. And I don't think that, you know, if they're hanging around, and I've been kind of following Trevor Story's rehab because I have him on a couple of fantasy teams, and it seems like he is going to play this year. Like, they could be pretty good by the end of July. If they're competitive by then, and it's a, you know, full slate, some of the pitching starts to work. They really haven't been very lucky there with the older pitchers yet. But, you know, if things start to click, like, yeah, that could be a fun summer, which I would not have, you know, if we were talking in March, we probably did. I would have seen this as being like an in-between year for them under the best of circumstances.
David Roth with us here on Dentari. We played that Muskrat Love for a reason here because of your recent piece.
I figured it out like a few minutes in. At first I was like, that's a lovely song. And no one plays it. Like, go ahead.
No, and again, I feel like I say this to you a lot, but it's, I have such respect because I know how distasteful you find the service that you provide for us in America, and yet no one seems to be able to get inside the head of dim-witted, unfunny billionaires like you, sir, David Roth.
Thank you. What an amazing honor. Thanks so much. The one issue that I'd take with that is that I think that Donald Trump was funny at one point. He hasn't been funny for a while. Elon Musk has always been the single probably wackest public American that we've got. Like, just there's, it's not there. He doesn't have the stuff. He's not an entertaining person to listen to. He doesn't have interesting thoughts that he expresses in an interesting way. And now he owns the platform where you and me and a bunch of other less discerning people had been trying out our dumb jokes for the last 12 years. And it's starting to feel entirely too much like him. It's really pretty grim over there, which is, it feels weird to say it because it's such a silly sight and everybody's always sort of goofed on it because of that. But like, I feel a real sort of sense of loss at how crappy Twitter has gotten. Like, I don't look forward to going on there. And
no,
you know, it wasn't ever the thing I look forward to most during the day, but I liked being on there, you know, when like a basketball game is on TV. And at this point, like, the vibe is still off. There's just a lot of negativity and a lot of sort of algorithmically surfaced turds in your mentions.
Yes. Yeah.
Anybody that pays for Twitter Blue, like, you're going to get their bad opinion before you get any of your friends' good ones. And that is not how you run a business.
And there was always a heap and helping of awfulness out there, but I had I thought of as my nice little community of relatively like-minded folks. Yesterday we were talking with actor Rich Sommer from Mad Men. He's in the new White House Plumbers, and he was great on Twitter, but Musk booted him off because he changed his handle to Elon Musk.
Yeah, there was a number of people that went out in a blaze of glory that way. That Sommer was one that I expected. I think he's great. I did not think that, you know, like, mild-mannered character actor Rich Sommer would be the guy that decides to fly the plane into the mountain, but good job, man. Nothing but respect for that. Obviously, I haven't been able to get off of there. I mean, this is the thing that's embarrassing about it, you know? Like, you get used to not just the sort of engagement and the experience of it, but there's a part of your brain that gets kind of embarrassingly gamified.
Yeah.
You know, where, like, I'm used to, I want to see the number go up, you know, and I'm on Blue Sky, which is the kind of, you know, the successor to Twitter, or at least, you know, one of the successors that people are talking about. And it looks like Twitter, the interface is good. The vibe there, you know, is much more positive. And, you know, there's just, it's invite only for the time being. So the creeps aren't there yet. And yet the numbers don't go up enough for me. Like, I keep right. going back to the other site because I need that serotonin boost.
Well, and as you pointed out, too, the strange thing, one of many strange things about Musk is he doesn't seem to understand the platform that he bought.
Yeah. I mean, I think he seems to like it in a way, and that's something that it's always been, you know, when, I remember when we talked to Matt Levine from Bloomberg, who's like the business columnist for me. I just think he's great. When Drew McGarry and I had him on our podcast for Defector months ago, after like right when the deal seemed to be closing, so it was probably 6-7 months ago, you know, none of us were bullish on the prospect of it. Elon's a terrible poster and a kind of a weird, impulsive guy, and he was already showing signs of the real reactionary politics that he's had now. But Levine pointed out that like he does like Twitter and he does use it, and that the people that were in charge of it at that time didn't. They were, you know, business types. They were Silicon Valley, you know, bankers and capitalists. And so for them, this was just a business that was underperforming, whereas Musk is passionate about it. He just, for all of that, he stinks at it, and he doesn't seem to have any of the, you know, so much of the fun of Twitter for me is not just about, you know, doing open mic shtick, you know, for other people. Like, it's the back and forth. It's listening.
Yeah.
I learn a lot of stuff from there. I've gotten so much of my news from there, like chaotically and probably, you know, in a lot of ways, in ways that have made me unhappy, because I don't know that people have necessarily evolved to handle the amount of bad news that you can get in an uncurated Twitter feed. But, you know, I don't think that Musk is a big listener. I don't think that he's a guy that really gets a whole lot out of other people. And I think that that was always the thing that was fun about Twitter, was, you know, that you could find anybody there. You could hear anything if you wanted to. It didn't cost you anything to follow anybody. And so you could build your own experience. And he's just not, he is a closed fist of a person. And I just think he does not want that. And if, you know, whatever else it is that you think the platform can provide, it doesn't do anything as well as it does that. And if you are steering away from that, then you're going to make it worse just by having made that decision, I think.
That's David Roth, Defector.com, the Distraction Podcast. He'll be doing his show nightly in the Brendan Byrne Arena right across from the Orange Julius.
Yes, no crowds. We're just sound checking the whole thing. We're EQing it. thank you for having me. And at the risk of being maudlin about something silly, it means a lot to be in the Hall of Fame for the show. I've loved coming on with you guys. It means a lot that people would vote for me in that silly poll. And now Ken Burns and I are enshrined in the same notional space. I could tell my parents about that if I thought they would understand what I was talking about.
Ken, I think, said the same thing about you. Well-deserved. Our listeners love you, and so do we. David, thank you as always. Have a great weekend.
Appreciate it, man. You too. Take care.